In Arctic regions in the spring of each year, the ice frozen thick on lakes and rivers first begins to thaw and then very gradually to break up. Pieces of ice break off from the main mass, turn and wheel in the eddying currents, and often as they move downstream form strange new and unexpected patterns. The great ice pack formed by the Cold War had begun to thaw long before 1971. But it was in 1971 that the melting ice began for the first time to form itself into patterns that were entirely new, with profound changes taking place in Europe, on the Indian subcontinent, and above all in the relations between the United States of America and the People's Republic of China. What the long-term consequences of these changes will be, we can't yet know. But that they will be important, for our children as well as ourselves, no one can doubt. 100 years hence, if men still live on this planet, 1971 will be remembered as having opened a new epoch in the relations amongst the states of the world. Appropriately enough, it was in the spring of the year that the first signs came of a new relationship between China and America. A table tennis team from the United States received a warm official reception in China in April, and President Nixon announced a relaxation of restrictions on American trade and travel with China. The president, in a television interview, went further.
What we've done is broken the ice. Now we have to test the water to see how deep it is. And I would finally suggest that, I know this question may come up if I don't answer it now, I hope, and as a matter of fact, I expect to visit mainland China.
Advance preparations for a visit must already have been underway. Because in July, following a secret visit to Peking by his foreign policy advisor Dr. Kissinger, Mr. Nixon announced that he would be visiting China soon, and in his capacity as president.
I have taken this action because of my profound conviction that all nations will gain from a reduction of tensions and a better relationship between the United States and the People's Republic of China. It is in this spirit that I will undertake what I deeply hope will become a journey for peace.
One immediate result of the changed American view was the dropping of American opposition to mainland China's admission to the United Nations. The Americans did, though, want nationalist China, Taiwan, to remain in the UN too. Against American wishes, a resolution was put to the General Assembly calling for mainland China's admission and the expulsion of Taiwan.
The result, the voting is as follows. In favor, 54, opposed, 59, abstention, 15. The resolution is adopted. The government of People's Republic of China will be notified accordingly.
The American ambassador to the UN, Mr. George Bush, had worked frantically behind the scenes to persuade a majority to keep both Chinas as members. Commenting afterwards, he didn't conceal his disappointment.
The United Nations today crossed a very dangerous bridge, and that's the question of expulsion. And time will tell. My country took a good deal of abuse in there by some intemperate people, and this is fine. There was lots of very noble opposition to our position. But in calm reflection, I think we're going to recognize that has been a very serious mistake.
The Americans were disappointed, but not dismayed. Nationalist China was no longer, as it had once been, central to their policy. On the other side of the world, in Western Europe, Britain's attempt to join the European Economic Community appeared at last to be moving towards a successful climax. The West Germans, for their part, had wanted Britain in for a long time, as their chancellor, Herr Willy Brandt, who later in the year was to be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for his Ostpolitik, made clear at a dinner in London.
I feel that in the next few weeks, sensible answers will have to be found to those questions which are still unresolved. We want Great Britain to find its place in the common market and in the European community. We think it is in the British interest, but this is not for us to judge. We have to judge our own interests and bring them into line with what we assess to be the interests of Europe. And the conclusion we have come to long ago is that Europe needs Great Britain.
But however anxious the Germans were to have Britain in Europe, they were even more anxious to preserve their newfound friendship with France. And it was the French who on two previous occasions had seen to it that Britain was excluded. The climax of the negotiations came, therefore, not in a smoke-filled room in Brussels, but in Paris in May, at a face-to-face meeting between the British Prime Minister and the French President. Mr. Heath used an interpreter during his private conferences with Monsieur Pompidou, but arriving at Orly Airport, he made a few formal remarks in a language that sounded just like French.
Je suis convaincu que nous vivons un moment historique comparable à celui d'il y a 20 ans, car il est certain que les décisions que nous prendrons tous dans les semaines à venir seront déterminantes pour l'avenir politique de l'Europe.
Fortunately for Mr. Heath, some would say for Britain, the attitude of France had changed. The French no longer saw Britain as a sort of Trojan horse making possible an American invasion of Europe. They'd tacitly abandoned as unrealistic the attempt to become again an independent great power. General de Gaulle was dead. Mr. Heath returned from Paris sure that the French would not say no again.
Twice we've been rebuffed. And last Friday evening in Paris, all that came to an end. And for the first time, all of the six members of the community said, we want you in. And it's of historic importance because it's the first time that the French and the Germans and the British, three great nations and former great powers, have all been of the same mind together, as well as our other friends, the Italians and the Dutch and the Belgians and those from Luxembourg. That's why it was a historic moment. The moment of opportunity for Britain and for Europe.
Nonetheless, a lot of hard bargaining remained to be done. On the size of Britain's contribution to the EEC budget, on sugar, on New Zealand, on inshore fishing. Indeed, agreement on some of the issues wasn't reached until December. But as early as June, Britain's common market negotiator, Geoffrey Rippon, after an all-night session of the Council of Ministers, at which all but one of the most contentious issues were settled, was confident that the final corner had been turned.
It is a historic day for you, for Europe. I mean, I've never doubted myself that the political will existed to bring about the enlargement of the community. I've never doubted that we would do, as in fact we've succeeded in doing, breaking the back of the negotiations by the summer. There are a number of matters still to be dealt with, some of considerable importance to the people affected, but we shall deal with them, and there can be no doubt now of the successful outcome of our negotiations.
The New Zealanders were not too unhappy, as their Prime Minister, Sir Keith Holyoake, admitted.
I am satisfied that the result is the best which the British could, in the circumstances, get for us. This is an achievement which will go a long way to avoid the damage to our economy which otherwise would have occurred. We've always said that the failure by the community to make a special arrangement for our trade would be disastrous to New Zealand. We can certainly now say that the disaster has been avoided.
Opposition in the Commonwealth and in Britain to EEC membership hadn't, however, abated with the passage of time. If anything, it was more intense in 1971 than in 1961, when the first British application was made. Enoch Powell was only one of a fairly large core of anti-Europeans on the Conservative backbenches.
I don't believe it is right, or even if it were desirable, that it would be possible, given opinion in this country, given the outlook, the background of this country, for this country to form part of one political entity with the nations of a Western European continent. If one nation enters a larger unit, then by definition, it surrenders its independence and its sovereignty. It's playing with words to pretend otherwise.
The Labour Party, for its part, was deeply divided. Some, like Roy Jenkins and George Thompson, thought that Britain should enter Europe, and that the terms negotiated by Mr. Rippon were probably the best that could have been got. Others, like Michael Foot, didn't want Britain to enter on any terms. Mr. Harold Wilson and some of his senior colleagues were in a difficult position. On the one hand, when they were in government, they'd applied for entry into the common market and spoken in glowing terms of the great promise that Europe held out. On the other, they were conscious that a majority in the country, and a majority in their own party, was now against entry. Mr. Wilson, at a special party conference in the summer, and with increasing vigor as the year went on, denied that the terms acceptable to a Conservative government would have been acceptable to Labour.
I reject the assertions, wherever they come from, that the terms this Conservative government have obtained are the terms the Labour government asked for. We did not, in fact, get involved in the negotiations. The terms the Labour government would have asked for, the terms the Labour government would have been bound to accept. I reject those assertions. Those terms, which we set out in detail in the Labour government's white paper of July 1967, and indeed made clear to Europe, are not the terms now before Parliament. And it is irresponsible for anyone who knows the facts to assert otherwise.
As the critical vote in the House of Commons drew near, pressure mounted on the pro-marketeers on the Labour side to fall into line. But the great majority of Labour's marketeers believed that they could not, in good conscience, agree to support conference's decision. Roy Jenkins, their leader, rejected the accusation that in supporting British entry into Europe, he and those who agreed with him were also supporting the Tory government.
I claim no monopoly of rightness or sincerity. But I do claim that we are entitled to stick to the beliefs which we have long held on this vital matter of principle. I don't apologize for doing so. I reject utterly the view that by sticking not only to the policy of the last government, but also to the most fundamental tenets of international socialism, we are supporting the Tories.
The vote, when it came on October the 28th, was the most dramatic the House of Commons had seen for 30 years, since the fall of Neville Chamberlain during the dark days of the war. Men and women on both sides of the House were torn as they'd not been torn before in this generation, between loyalty to their party and loyalty to their convictions. No one could know in advance how large the government's majority would be. In the end, it was far larger than almost anybody'd expected, 112. 39 Conservatives voted against Europe, but they were far more than offset by the 69 Labour MPs who reluctantly but resolutely went into the government lobby in favour. What was Geoffrey Rippon's reaction?
Well, naturally, I'm very, very pleased. I think it's a great result. And I think it's shown Parliament as all of us would really wish it to be. I don't know what various members will do. We know the difficulties that might arise. I simply believe that at the end of the day, no matter how long the discussion may be about the bill, we will become full members of the community on the 1st of January 1973.
But the difficulties Mr. Rippon hinted at were very real. A significant number of Conservatives had come out against the policy of their own government, and it was one thing for Labour MPs to vote with the Conservatives on a single symbolic occasion, quite another for them to support the government in the lobbies on the common market legislation day after day. Mr. Wilson, publicly at least, took it for granted that the Labour rebels wouldn't go on rebelling.
But of course it won't happen again. I said in the debate this afternoon that tonight's vote is not the end, it is the beginning. I do respect our people, those of our people who have been so heavily committed or regard it as an issue of principle. We shall have to consider what happens next, but I am certain that he will have to stand on his own two feet so far as getting next year's legislation through, and this will be a very, very different state of affairs.
At the end of 1971, it was still too early to say whether Parliament would enact the necessary legislation. But at least one old man lived in hope, Jean Monnet, the father of Europe, who'd worked for European unity ever since the war, and unlike so many of his fellow countrymen, was convinced from the beginning that Europe without Britain wasn't Europe at all.
I think Great Britain would bring to Europe one essential thing. The British have a respect for institutions and understand institutions better than the Continentals. We on the continent think that men settle problems. They don't. They need institutions to settle them. And you understand that, as has been proved by the British Parliament over the last 100 years.
Every year has, as well as its events, its non-events. And the great non-event of 1971, how long ago it seems already, was decimalisation. In the weeks before February the 15th, decimalisation was talked about in Britain almost as much as the weather. Almost everybody imagined that confusion would last for months and months, with shop girls giving the wrong change all the time, and old people quite incapable of telling one new coin from another. Lord Fisk, the chairman of the Decimal Currency Board, was having to justify the change right up to the end.
We are gaining for anybody who handles cash. That is really for any business, any shop, any office, any transport undertaking, let's leave it at those four, a reduction in costs because of the very simplified accounting systems that come out of decimalization and because of the greater facility in handling money and in giving change. That, I think, is one great thing. Once we're used to the system, it will be easier for us in our everyday working, in our everyday shopping and getting about the world.
But if decimalization went smoothly enough, all was still not well with the British economy. To be sure, the country's balance of payments problem had disappeared, at least for the time being. But what replaced it affected even more directly the families of a million workers. Vic Feather of the TUC voiced widespread anger and dismay.
I didn't think that the generation born during the war and since would ever in their lifetime see nationwide demonstrations on unemployment. I thought we had put all that behind us. I thought that whatever else we might have to suffer, we would never have large-scale unemployment again. Yet, in the short space of 18 months, this government has pushed the people back almost 40 years, almost back into the days of Jarrow.
But as the Prime Minister insisted at the Conservative Party conference, it didn't want to do anything in the present that would only store up trouble for the future.
We stand now on the threshold of a period of growth and prosperity unparalleled since the war. We must deal, of course, with the immediate economic problems, and particularly that of unemployment. But we must do so in the context of the future. We are not going to be accused of neglecting the future in order only to remedy the present. For that way, we know, lies frustration. And we have had enough frustration over the past generation or more.
One source of that frustration, the government believed, had been the chaotic state of Britain's industrial relations. And a large proportion of the time of Parliament in 1971 was devoted to passing a new Industrial Relations Act. Robert Carr, the Secretary for Employment and the Act's sponsor, didn't believe it would work miracles. But he did believe that in time it would lead to much more orderly industrial procedures.
We don't believe that this bill is going to act directly against strikes. It's not meant to do that. Our philosophy is that if one creates a framework of rules for management, for trade unions, for individuals, duties and rights, but a framework of rules, then these rules will gradually but steadily begin to affect the way in which unions and management do their business together and will produce a more orderly conduct of industrial relations. The effect will be gradual rather than particular.
It was Vic Feather who spoke again for a hostile labour movement.
Our attack on this bill is more than a defence of trade unions, more even than a defence of people's living standards. It is a defence of democracy, a defence of freedom of association. Our attack on this bill is to defend the rights of working people, to forge the tools whereby we can carve out of the future higher and nobler standards of life, and generations of people, working people in the past, struggled and suffered to hand on to us our present freedoms. We cannot fail their memory and their trust.
Despite sustained Labour opposition in the House of Commons and in the country, the bill did become law. But not before two bombs had been exploded at the home of Mr. Carr. Speaking later, Mr. Carr said there was one thing he was sure of.
The overwhelming majority of trade unionists, including what I believe to be the minority who are opposed to my bill, would be the very first to be outraged by this sort of incident.
Vic Feather was outraged and said so.
I think the character of the British people is such, and trade unions are British people, don't overlook that, will you? And we're a pretty sizable proportion of British people. We resent this kind of thing. It's one of the great prides that we've all got, I think, that we can disagree in this country, we can express opposite points of view, without being threatened either with batons or with bludgeons.
The government not only took legislative action on the industrial front, it also sought to stem rising wages and prices by resisting strongly wage claims in the public sector. It was the Union of Post Office Workers which struck first. The postmen stayed out for 47 days, remaining determined till the end. But without strike pay, they couldn't carry on indefinitely, and the absence of postal services caused much less inconvenience than anybody'd imagined. The UPW's mustachioed Tom Jackson was bitter about the final outcome.
It looks to me that postmen and telephonists and counterclerks are being used as some sort of breakwater for inflation, the national interest and so on, and I don't think that's fair.
Critics of Britain's bid to enter Europe complained that even in the absence of a formal political union, Britain would be surrendering part of her sovereignty, her ability to determine her own destiny. In fact, by 1971, the countries of the world had become so interdependent, economically, politically, even culturally, that to speak the language of national sovereignty was already to speak a dead language. As though this simple point still needed to be driven home, on the 4th of February 1971, Rolls-Royce, one of the most famous of all British enterprises, went into liquidation. Its bankruptcy caused by a single disastrous fixed-price contract for the RB211 engine with an American company, Lockheed's. Frederick Corfield, the aviation minister, defended the decision to nationalise rather than subsidise.
Well, you feed in more money and you simply underwrite all the liabilities of an undertaking which has gone into liquidation as a result of really the grossest underestimation of the risks attached to this particular country. And I don't think it's the function of government to underwrite the risks of private enterprise. It is the function of government to make sure that we preserve the really the parts of Rolls-Royce that are essential to the national interest.
The British company, in collapsing, ironically threatened to take the American company down with it. And in the end, the United States Senate, by a single vote, saved the whole RB211 project by agreeing to provide Lockheed's with government-guaranteed loans. But for this decision by the legislature of a foreign country, some 20,000 British workers would almost certainly have lost their jobs. So much for sovereignty. America and Britain depended on one another over Rolls-Royce and Lockheed. America and almost the whole rest of the world depended on each other for a solution to America's chronic balance of payments problem, and more generally for a satisfactory realignment of the values in relation to each other of the world's major currencies. Few industrial countries had currencies valued at the point optimal for the growth of world trade. The American dollar was clearly overvalued, causing American goods to be too costly on world markets. The Japanese yen was equally clearly grossly undervalued, causing Japanese goods to flood into the home markets of other countries. The danger was that instead of a negotiated agreement, there would be a trade war, with each country seeking to defend its own position by attacking the others. In August, it looked for a moment as though President Nixon might be declaring just such a war.
The time has come for decisive action. In recent weeks, the speculators have been waging an all-out war on the American dollar. The strength of a nation's currency is based on the strength of that nation's economy. And the American economy is by far the strongest in the world. Accordingly, I have directed the Secretary of the Treasury to take the action necessary to defend the dollar against the speculators.
Higher tariff walls and competitive devaluations could only lead to a contraction of world trade, to the impoverishment of everybody. Conscious that this was the alternative, the major industrial nations had by the end of the year completed a major currency realignment. Mr. Nixon's toughness in August probably helped to bring this about, but the president himself wasn't disposed to claim the credit.
The question will inevitably be asked when each returns to his country, as it will be asked of Secretary Connolly and me when we report to the Congress. Who won? Who lost? And the answer is, when agreements are reached in which all parties bargain hard and fight hard for their positions, when that agreement is mutually reached, then it is an agreement which is to the mutual benefit of both. What has happened here is that the whole free world has won.
Rolls-Royce wasn't the only British company to go bankrupt in 1971, threatening the jobs of thousands of workers. Early in the summer, the managing director of Upper Clyde Shipbuilders announced that the group could no longer carry on unless it were provided with additional government aid. But the government refused to provide working capital anymore. John Davis, the Secretary for Trade and Industry, was asked why not.
Because I haven't got confidence that if I did, they would not, within a matter of months, and perhaps a few months only, be back again at my doorstep saying, sorry, it's not got wrong this, right this time, but give us a few more millions and off we go again, and we promise you won't come back again, and then you come 6 months later and off it all goes again. I'm afraid that this is the not only the reputation, but it's bound to be the impression that this company has created and the judgment that I've had to reach about it.
This denial of funds and Mr. Davis's later announcement that two of the four UCS yards would probably be closed had an electric effect on the firm's workforce. Far from accepting what some saw as the inevitable, the workers at UCS in late July occupied the yards themselves, carried on working, and appealed for outside support. Their spokesman, the leader of their shop stewards, Jimmy Reed, hurled defiance at the government.
Have a look at this document. There are unsubstantiated contentions in it. There are no figures. But it's the slaughter of our industry. And I think there should be nobody under any illusions. There is no guarantee of any unit surviving. And if it were to survive, they would want us to grovel, to go on their hands and knees to them in silver birthright. But even then, there is no guarantee. And he's got the effrontery, that is Davis, to ask us for our cooperation. It's like cooperating in your own self-destruction.
At the end of the year, all four UCS yards were still open, though only just. It remained to be seen whether, given the government's reluctance to subsidize UCS further, some commercially viable solution could be found.